We're going to have a change of pace this morning at On the Menu. But first of all, as Anne says, welcome to On the Menu Radio with Peter and Anne Haig. And Peter's taking the lead in introducing his program because it's the only time he's going to get a word in edgeways, hardly, throughout the rest of the program. Because we have three great lady guests today, all of whom most recently famous and joining us on the menu because they've recently produced exceptional books. First of all, Anne Willen. I don't know how you describe Anne. It's unfair to say that she's like the grand master of
lady
cooking, an absolute icon.
I mean, the most iconic book on country cooking of France. Her school, La Varenne, tell me anybody who hasn't gone,
The most remarkable thing about that, and I commented again in the interview, and Anne just is totally nonplussed and doesn't seem to think it was particularly exciting. But how she came to set up Slate as a cooking school run by an English woman in Paris and expected people to come, I'm not sure. But I think when they went, they certainly found out.
Yes.
That this is a great
very,
lady.
Very, very talented, great
and,
lady.
And it turns out she and her husband have another hobby, collecting historical cookbooks. And if you don't understand why and you don't understand what that means and what you can get out of it, well, then listen to the next 20 minutes and you'll find out. Then right after that, Crescent Dragon Wagon from Vermont, who admits to having written 40 books, although she quickly points out that they're not all cookbooks.
Yeah, she's the children's book.
But having done a cookbook recently dedicated to corn, called the Cornbread Gospels, she decided to go one better and produce an entire book on beans.
Yeah.
So bean to bean is her contribution, and that's coming up in the second segment. And then in the third segment, an interesting new trend, Rebecca Miller for French, after the English for Frenches. She talks about recipes as a way of keeping family history alive. So without hesitation, here we go to Anne Willen and what's the name of the book?
Oh, I'm sorry.
I see. I caught you off guard. You were supposed to be paying attention.
I was not paying attention.
She's not
you want me
attention.
To give you the name of the...
It's really not important.
It's called The Cookbook Library, 4 centuries of the cooks, writers, and recipes that made the modern cookbook. But I say that again in the interview.
Yeah, I didn't mean it. I mean, it means you repeat yourself and have such a long title.
Yes.
It might be the longest one we have on record and on the menu. But this is a wonderful interview. I'm sure you'll enjoy.
We have interviewed Anne Willen before for On the Menu, particularly about her wonderful book, The Country Cooking of France, which we frequently use as we were telling you. Welcome to On the Menu, Anne.
Very glad to be with you again.
Right. And now Anne, of course, is so well known for all her cookbooks and her awards. And she, of course, founded the famous La Varenne Cooking School. I think you must have, I don't know how many students you have there, but I think everyone we've interviewed has gone to La Varenne.
Uh-huh.
So anyhow, this is a slightly different book. It's actually called The Cookbook Library, 4 centuries of the cooks, writers, and recipes that make the modern cookbook. And I don't know, it is such, when I say dense, I mean in the most wonderful, marvelous sense of that term, filled with information that you didn't even know that you didn't know and are so happy to have now. You began collecting cookbooks with your husband, Mark Czerniawski, is that correct? And in the 60s, you have, what, 400 volumes, these cookbooks?
Well, we have about 200 old cookbooks that are kind of before 1800.
Uh-huh.
Then the rest, we have probably the 115 cookbooks from the 1900s, and then more in the 20th, and of course modern books too.
Right. Now, you have a section, actually. Mark has written about the collection, the actual act of collecting, and apparently when you started out, it was not a crowded field, so you got some good bargains, but now I think it would be not quite as easy, right?
Well, one of the wonderful things that's happened in the last few years is that people have got really interested in culinary history. When we first started collecting cookbooks, it's nearly 40 years ago, we started very small with comparatively modern books, but nobody was really interested in the older books or where cookbooks started. And now there must be at least a dozen organizations of culinary historians around the country. Do you have one in your area?
I don't know. I would check on that, I would think.
Yeah, they're on the web. I mean, the chapters on the whole are independent, but they list on the web.
Okay.
So there is an there's a loose association of people who are doing the same kind of thing as you are?
Exactly.
And there's so much, it's more than just a collection of cookbooks. It's an approach to studying people and their habits, the way they lived, the way they ate, the social structure, everything, since you start with antiquity and move forward.
Well, that, I think, is a lovely thing about cookbooks and recipes and eating and cooking, is that indeed it reflects the times when people were doing whatever different recipes they were doing. I found I got very distracted, got into things like, when did women start going into the kitchen?
Yes, you have a section on that, the very first woman cookbook, a cookbook by a woman, actually. You said there were earlier ones, but mainly they were ghostwritten by men, or is that what you said?
Absolutely. That's in the 17th century. And, of course, it implies when women started writing cookbooks for women, it implied much more literacy than there had been before. And apparently, I didn't know this, it's a very complicated subject, literacy. There's very little that was studied about it early on, so nobody really quite knows what was going on. But one thing is certain, and that is that many more men knew how to read and write before women.
I never thought of that either till I read this book. So you might write a cookbook, but the person who you were writing for was not the person who was your daily cook in the household.
Exactly.
Right.
And the very early cookbook was commissioned by the very, very rich, like kings and cardinals and popes. I mean, that's the first four cookbooks in the 15th century, towards the end of the 15th century. This is printed cookbook. I really know very little about the earlier manuscript cookbooks. And even in the 16th century, it's, I think, though it's very difficult to know for certain, that very few, if any, cooks could read.
Right.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. It's all very well for Gutenberg to develop the printing press and be able to print large numbers of copies that were affordable, but the biggest issue, of course, was whether or not people could read. So it wasn't much point in writing a cookbook if people couldn't read it, and most people couldn't.
The people who really began reading them were the stewards of great households.
Uh-huh.
In other words, they were boss of the cook, and they were running households for the very wealthy, for cardinals, and for the dukes and then nobility, particularly, I think, in Italy and France, but anywhere where there was plenty of money.
You also talk about the early stages of writing.
The estes.
That was a new thing altogether, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. That was the sort of Renaissance and the High Renaissance, and people started really thinking about the art of cookery as opposed to, which I think it had mainly been before, massive feasts to impress followers and, the people who you wanted to influence. Unless you go back to the Romans, and then the Romans indeed were looking at food in an artistic, as art. But a printed book, starting at the end of the 15th century, kind of outline just the beginnings of thinking food as different from eating to live and eating to impress.
Now, I had supposedly a cookbook. It was in Italian, and it was a volume in a series. And mainly, it was, I think it would fit into your chapter about maitre d's, because there were all these huge banquet presentations, and it broke down to how you built these great centerpieces and the feast displays. Yeah, and all these engravings with these presentations. So that probably would be, I think it was a 19th century cookbook.
Yes, and they were doing something very similar in the 18th century. A lot of sugar work and a lot of what the French called pièce montée, the nearest thing we know are wedding cakes.
Okay, that's interesting.
You know, nearly always going upwards in a kind of pyramid, and indeed constructed in all sorts of different coloured sugars and great fun.
Yes.
How lucky you are to have one of those books.
Yes, unfortunately I gave it to a chef friend, but I'm not so sure he was ever going to use it.
Well, I hope he gave you some good meals instead.
He did. Now, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about was I enjoyed the colorful characters in your history. Who are some of the outstanding figures that you could note that contributed to this history of cookbook writing?
Well, I think the underlying thing about a really good cookbook is that the person who's writing it loves what they're doing. They have a kind of passion that communicates itself on the page. The very first printed cookbook was by Platina, and he was a Vatican librarian. And he wasn't just giving people recipes, but he was telling people how to eat and how to live a long life and how to maintain your health. And one of the things, for example, he says is that sex is wiser at night than in the afternoon. He was not a cook, but in the next century, you get the cooks written for stewards. One of them really stands out in my mind, and that is Bartolomeo Scarpi.
Oh, yes.
His book was printed in 1570, and it's a big book. The recipes are extremely detailed, so he gives little hints like keep your cauldron covered so that the food that's being simmered doesn't taste smoky.
Oh, good. That's interesting, isn't it?
It wouldn't have had a good chance of being smoky, I guess, because kitchens were certainly smoky places.
Yes, they must have been very smoky. Because, they had chimneys by then, not just an open space in the middle of the hall. But if the wind was wrong or the fire wasn't stoked properly, then you would indeed have had a lot of gusts of smoke travelling out into the room. And one interesting thing that one doesn't think about is lighting in a kitchen.
Yeah, I read that.
Mainly lit by the flames of the fire. But you don't awfully want a flaming fire, you want a glowing fire. And I bet many kitchens couldn't afford candles, so it would have been difficult to see when it was dark.
And the times for eating dinner probably related a bit to the light source too, when you were able to see enough to cook it, huh?
Well, not only cook it, to eat it.
To eat it as well, yes.
And so, yes. And until the 18th century, you can't really assume that even people with quite a lot of money could afford to eat after dark on a regular basis.
Well, that's, again, things we never even thought about.
No.
It's amazing. Is there any other figures in the history of cooking that you found fascinating?
Well, women, of course, are fascinating, because once women start writing cookbooks for women, you are looking at a totally different market, because women really were in there running kitchens. Not uncommonly, they were also actually doing the cooking. So they're not just doing recipes of sort of grand things to eat. They're doing recipes for everyday family eating, healthy eating, quite a lot of preserving, and they not uncommonly include medicines as well.
Yes.
Now, your book contains a lot of recipes. I know I mentioned this before, but and you actually tested these?
Oh, yes, absolutely. That was great fun.
And were some of them good and some of them not so good?
Yes. The further you go back, the more difficult it is to really know what things must have tasted like, because the ingredients were different. The heat sources, certainly at the beginning, you were cooking over the open fire. I mean, it wasn't until the 18th century that what they call a raised stove, that's to say, cooking over a barbecue, really, a charcoal grill at waist height, was moderately common. Before that, you had long-handled frying pans and great big cauldrons over an open fire. So the kind of things you could cook were different. You couldn't do tricky sauces and long-cooked braises that had to simmer very slowly unless you were really good at controlling the fire.
You did modernize. There are these recipes in the book, but you modernized them for today's kitchen?
Yes, I did. But I tried very hard to imagine what the ingredients were like and the kind of way they must have been cooked. So if you go back to medieval times, you don't have runny sauces because people on the whole were eating with their fingers. The food was, they didn't have plates. Of course there were plates, but there were not very many of them. So the average feast, food was served on what they called a trencher of bread, a thick slice of bread. And tranché in French means to slice. And so you put your food on top of the bread, and it was fine if it had a nice, rich, but sticky sauce that held its shape. It would just kind of soak into the bread. But you couldn't have something that would run all over the place.
Just amazing. There's so much information here in this book. I have to ask you this. Did you invest in the Modernist Cuisine multi-volume series?
Yes, I did.
Is that amazing?
Fascinating. As it happens, Nathan Meerwold, who masterminded it,
yes,
was a student of ours.
Oh, really? Okay.
So that's how he got interested.
No, he was already interested. And he said, oh, I want to come on your advanced class. And I said, we wouldn't take you unless you had some culinary experience. And so for 2 years, he worked on Saturday night at Rover's in Seattle.
Oh, I know. We know him.
With Thierry.
Oh, yeah.
With Thierry.
Yeah. Good
and
guy.
So after that, I said with a bit of reluctance, because I thought he was one of these idealistic, visionary types that wouldn't be able to cook. And, of course, I was totally wrong.
He's on a sequel, actually, to this.
Oh, my God.
Who would know that people would spend $450 on a cookbook series?
I don't know. Have you seen it? Do you have it?
I have not. I've seen all the articles with the illustrations. I do not own it. No.
It's the most astonishing series. I disagree with quite a lot he says, or rather the way he looks at things. I think he get carried away by the scientific aspects of things, but it is undoubtedly a step into the future. The illustrations are amazing.
Oh, yes.
And beautiful.
Here's the $64,000 question, Anne.
Yes.
This book is, the typeface is about 6-point. In order to be able to get it into the covers, it's pretty small, and spent a lot of time preparing for this, reading it. She's been complaining about her eyes recently.
Oh, he's making this up.
How did you imagine that people might use this book? Or maybe you didn't care.
It's quite dense, as you say, but it has wonderful illustrations. They're all taken from, or almost all, not the very earliest ones, from our collection of gastronomic prints and from the cookbooks themselves. An illustration in quite a lot of cases is as good as 1,000 words, and actually I'm looking at a wonderful illustration of something called the larder, It's a print taken from a Flemish painting of 1580, and it shows the different ingredients that you might have found in a really well-stocked larder. And it has deer, and it has wild boar, and it has a rather nice greyhound hoping to get a sniff of all this wonderful game, and it has lobsters and what look like thrushes and hares. And so that tells you, just at a glance, what people were thinking of eating of in 1580.
That's absolutely amazing. Now, where did you cut off at the recent history end? I mean, you started as far back as the beginning as you could. When does this book actually stop?
Well, the problem was to stop.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I wanted to stop with the 19th century, because there's an explosion of outstanding books in the 19th century. People have written a great deal about them. And so I sort of stopped with Brillat Savarin in 32. But I've, at the end, taken a sort of look into what became the future and said, all of these books started with the four first printed cookbooks before 1501. And they lead into the 19th century and the different genre of cookbooks. For instance, celebrity chefs really got going in the 19th century. That's to say people like Karam,
yes,
Karam cooks for the Tsar of Russia, for the Prince Regent, and for Talleyrand at the Congress of Vienna. He described it all. He travelled all over. He was a celebrity in his own right.
He was brought to Russia by Catherine the Great.
Yeah, was he?
Yes.
I didn't realise it was Catherine.
Yeah, well, Anne's an expert on Catherine the Great. She read a book almost as big as yours about Catherine the Great. So she's an expert.
All about it.
Now I have a suggestion that you haven't thought about as to what you can do with Nathan Meerhold's book. You can sit on it in the kitchen.
Well, you develop your muscles by just listening.
I know.
Well, there are plenty of other books out there that are perfect for making brick chicken, but this is not one of those. It's a cold winter evening, and you don't feel like cooking, but you want to get involved in the process of food anyway. You can just pick up this book and read a few pages.
He's now talking about your book.
Yes, I'm back to your book. The Cookbook Library is the name of the book.
And it's a delight. I thank you so much for writing this, because it gives us all kinds of new insights into the whole culinary scene of past and present and future.
And we can't imagine what project you'll take on next, but we're sure it'll be exciting, and we're sure we'll talk to you about it when that happens. In the meantime, thank you so much for joining us today on The Menu.
Thank you both. It was lovely to talk to you again.
Thanks.
And yes, Peter's still here, and he's going to say, let's take a break.
Podcasting services for On The Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to Anne and Peter Haig with On The Menu Radio. This is Peter again, about to fade into the background as we launched into an interview with Crescent Dragon Wagon. It's hard to pronounce, especially three times quickly. But here she is talking all about beans and her cookbook, Bean by Bean.
Well, this is not the first time we've talked to Crescent Dragon Wagon, since she's already produced 50 books, or this is, I guess, your 50th, Crescent, right?
It is, Anne. They aren't all culinary books. I write children's books as well.
Right.
But it's probably, it's my 8th or 9th cookbook.
And it's called Bean by Bean, which is something really close to my heart. And I just drool even looking at the cover of your book, because it has the chickpeas and lentils and kidney beans and black beans.
They did such a beautiful job with the cover, which really shows off the inherent loveliness of dry beans. And in my own kitchen home, I both presently and long before I wrote this book, one element of the kitchen is always quart or half-gallon mason jars filled with different kinds of beans.
Oh, I love them.
Shapes and their colors and their patterns and the dappled ones and the small ones and the large ones, and they're just lovely to look at. I think they're prettier dried than cooked, but
yeah,
of course they're more delicious by far cooked. So
you have a very good section in the back of the book. If people get confused, it's in your appendix. You have basic beanery, and you go through all these different kinds of beans.
Bean by bean.
Yeah, bean by bean.
But, you know, essentially, with a very few exceptions, if you learn how to cook, how to soak, rehydrate, cook, and season any sort of dry bean, you've got the keys to the kingdom. You can cook any other kind. The length of time might be a little different, but I often say that beans are like people in that while they may look very different and appear very different and be a little different, when it comes to the inside, they're more alike than they are different.
I'm fascinated with the colors of them and so forth, but there's this poetry about them that you start your book off with. That tell us a little bit about that. You relate it to everything.
Well,
it fertilizes its own soil. It makes tendrils. Talk to us about that, your poetry of beans.
You know, first of all, if a writer is fortunate enough to have the right subject and they really focus on it and they're a good writer and they take the time, it can serve as like a lens to view the whole world. And beans are quite astonishing that way. If you look at if you were to take one of those dry beans like it's pictured on the cover and put it in the palm of your hand and look at it, you right then have a couple of choices. You could join it with hundreds of its fellows and soak it and cook it and have it for dinner tonight. Or you could soak it overnight and then rinse it and drain it a couple of times and sprout it and then have it again for dinner in a couple of days, but salad or stir fry. Or you could take that same little dry bean and plant it in your garden, and in about a week it would start to come up. And there's a reason why children are given beans as their first little seed to grow, because they germinate quickly and they're very dramatic. You can see that it's that it's a bean when it comes up. It's because it's wearing the sort of split bean as a little hat before its first leaves come out. And then as it grows, some sorts of beans, probably most of us are familiar, peas among this, when they're just little blue greens, they're edible at that phase. And then if they keep growing, eventually they bear little pods. And you can have the pods when they're tiny and tender and thin, or you can let them grow fatter and eat them when they're more like your standard green beans, which, of course, depending on your variety, might not just be green. You might have yellow ones. You might have purple ones, which, although they turn back green.
Yeah, don't you think that's funny how those colored beans turn up green when you cook them?
Well, it's a very interesting thing, and the most interesting part to me about it, the purple ones turn green, but if you happen to have a pot that is lined with white enamel and you cook them in it, you will see that a few minutes after you remove the formerly purple, now green beans from the water, the cooking water, and like most cooking waters, it has a little tint, and the tint is sort of green when you take the beans out. But with those purple beans, in a couple of minutes, that cooking water turns to a bright turquoise blue.
Wow.
Which is just fabulous and strange, and if you cook with children, it's very fun to drop the beans in the boiling water and watch them turn from purple to green, because you can watch it happen if you have the right color pot so you can see it, but it's pretty dramatic. And then suddenly the cooking water changes. So they really are not just in Jack and the Beanstalk.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, is that why we have Jack and the Beanstalk, because of the reasons you're giving?
I don't know how Jack and the Beanstalk exactly began, but it is true that pole beans grow up and up and up and up and up and up. So you could imagine them growing to the sky, and in fact, my partner took pictures of some of our pole beans in the garden, and he took it from down on ground level looking up, and you can see this bright blue sky behind it and the little tendrils sort of waving in the air, and you can really, you can kind of imagine how you could get there to Skyland and Giant Land. But so anyway, to continue with part of the amazingness of them, so you can eat them as a bean, like a green bean, or if you let them stay on the plant a little longer until you can sort of see the beans pressing against the pod in a nice pregnant row, then if you peel them out of the pod, you shuck them, then you have fresh beans, not green beans, but like fresh shell beans, which some people refer to shellies or shuck, and they look like a dry bean, but they're not all the way dried, and, you know, there's still tender enough thumbnail in them, and they cook anywhere from 12 to 30 minutes, and they are wonderful, creamy, they're a little starchy, but not as starchy as a dry bean, and they're just luxurious and wonderful, and if you don't grow beans yourself, you can probably get shuck beans in the fall at farmers market.
Right. You just hinted at something that I want you to explain, is because a lot of people look at beans, well, there are two things that they consider. The first one is they think of them as just being starchy. Now, they're very high in protein.
They are extremely high in protein. They're the single highest protein plant-based food on the planet, higher than nuts. Soybean is complete protein. But all the other beans are also high in protein, and if you eat them with rice or corn tortilla or whole grain bread, complete protein. So, yeah, they have carbohydrate, but their carbohydrate is very slowly digested, so it gives a great deal of satiety, satisfaction, sense of fullness, along with the protein. And even people that are diabetic do quite well with beans because they're so slowly digested. They don't cause one of those spikes in blood sugar.
Yeah.
And so people really, you know, they're inexpensive,
yes,
and they're good for the planet. They're sustainable. They're the only plant food that actually, and by they, I mean everyone in the legume family, which is beans and peas and a few oddities like peanuts
right,
are a bean, they actually add nitrogen to the soil while they're growing. Now, every plant, I mean, when we walk on the earth is essentially millenniums of decayed vegetable matter. That's what soil or ground or earth is. So all plants do give back after they're dead. But the beans, even while they're growing and producing food for human beings and for animals, even while they're growing, on a molecular level, they're adding nitrogen.
Yeah. So if you know even the basics of crop rotation, you know that they get rotated in and out just because of that, right?
Yes, yes, exactly. I mean, they're an amazing plant, and I feel honored that I've gotten to write about them for so long.
Well, now, let's talk a little bit more about your book. You cover beans for just about I'm talking recipes now, really great recipes that are very exciting. Everything from appetizers to soup, main courses, and even dessert. But you cheated a little on this dessert by including the peanuts.
Oh, not really, because peanuts are beans. And I certainly used peanuts in the main courses as well, so why shouldn't they show up in desserts?
Well,
I do have red bean ice cream.
Yeah, I was going to say the Chinese have red bean ice cream that would work.
Yeah, there is a gorgeous cake in there. This is one of my favorite recipes in it, and we run into anything much like it elsewhere. It's called the Rose of Persia cake.
I love that name.
Oh, because it has rose water in it.
Yeah, well, everything's good with rose water.
And it has a lot of other ingredients that are typical Persian Iranian ingredients, but it's a cake that the flour is half wheat flour and half garbanzo bean flour.
Right.
And it has dried cherries in it, also typically Iranian, soaked in cherry juice, and you reserve the cherry juice back and you make that into a little glaze to pour over, and then you top the whole thing with finely chopped pistachio nuts, and it is a wonderful cake, and very fragrant, scented with roses. It is out of this world.
Yeah.
And if you can make a, like, basic front cake. You can make that cake.
Well, you know, I'm sure you're so familiar with beans and the subject of beans, but I love beans too, but I have a favorite. You must have a favorite.
Well,
or a couple.
I mean, I have several favorites, but again, sort of depends what mood I'm in.
Right.
I love black beans in a lot of different ways.
That's
There's
my
a very
favorite
simple,
bean.
There's a very simple Cuban black bean soup recipe in there that is so good. And I also make a vegetarian feijoada that I call feijoada. Now, that, and like many other beans, make a stew. This is true of most stews, but I think it's even more so of beans. Whether you make a stew or a chili, it is good the first day, better the second day, and by about the third day, it is over the top good because the flavors get a chance to sort of saturate each other and blend and become unified. And so certainly feijoada, if I was serving it to company, I would serve it on the second or third day.
Well, I used to do that for an open house.
Well, I do it anyway. I mean, I just did my famous stew that we just had for lunch today. This was day three. I made it.
Isn't it amazingly better than...
Well, we sort of knew that, and I guess it's not really news. It's interesting that the same thing applies to meatless dishes as well.
Yeah,
now, this is touching on something that we should mention, is you yourself are and have been for a long, long time a vegetarian, and throughout the book you have identified recipes that are vegetarian, vegan, or meat.
And I also put in gluten-free
fast is growing. Yeah, I find that amazing. But anyhow, everybody has options. This is not just vegetarians. You associate beans with vegetarians, and it's not. You can add meat, you can take it away, you can do all kinds of things with the kinds
exactly.
of recipes that you did.
Well, I mean, I really believe that tables and eating, it's a generous thing, and it's really about bringing people together for nourishment and pleasure and interaction with each other, with the earth. And so rather than let it divide us by those categories, you know, oh, vegetarian, gluten-free, can't eat this, can't eat that, oh, I have to cook for so-and-so, they're so difficult. Rather than do that, join together at a table, and I am completely accepting of the fact there are people out there to whom it is incomprehensible that you would make a pot of beans without a ham hock in it. You know, I get that. And then I also get that there are many people out there, not just vegetarians, but, for example, Jews or Muslims who don't eat pork. It would be disgusting to them to imagine adding a ham hock, a piece of pork, to a pot of beans. And so, cool with making some pots of beans, you know, and having everybody eat and be at peace. I just think that too often we let things like that divide us. And so, you know, I actually did write the precursor to Bean by Bean, skinny little book. It was Workman Publishing's first cookbook.
And you were a teenager.
I was 18 when
it
was published. It was published in 1972, which if you add quickly, you can figure out all that. And it was called The Bean Book. And it cost $2.45. And just as an aside, isn't it interesting that nothing costs blank 45 anymore? It's always 95 now. But anyway, so at that time, I still ate meat. And so I knew how to, you know, I know those recipes are good. Some I retested by giving them to friends that, or testers, you know, just to go over the recipe one more time. But I ate meat then, and I knew they were good then, so I remembered them fondly and included them. And pretty so often over those years between 1972 and now, I got actually, I think it was a total of three different letters from people who had lost their bean books, you know, one to a fire, one to a move, one to a divorce, and they wanted a particular recipe from it. And in a couple of those cases, it was the same baked bean recipe that had salt pork in it. So I thought, dragon wagon, you're not going to leave that out. You know, people love that recipe. They found you to get you to send them that recipe. Put the damn recipe in. So I sometimes say I'm a laissez-faire, F-A-R-E, vegetarian.
That's very good.
So.
But anyhow, let's just repeat that this is, because we haven't talked nearly enough about all the varieties of recipes, just suffice it to say that you cover the globe, you cover history, you cover cooking techniques, different types of beans. It's a treasure of anybody who's interested in exploring legumes in all their glory.
They'll have fun exploring it, too, with or without my book. I mean, my book might give them some ideas and help them think about it in a new way, but it's just a fascinating world, and too many people are intimidated by merely soaking the beans and then cooking them. I mean, I have been surprised at how many people that are good practice cooks have never fixed from scratch. They've just opened a can. And, you know, I don't think you go to hell for opening a can of beans.
Yeah,
There's plenty of recipes in there that use canned beans, but it is easy and so much cheaper and so much tastier. A chickpea cooked from scratch, you can't imagine how different it is from a chickpea out of a can.
Yeah, our farmers' markets now are carrying them in the pod, which the first time I saw them growing, I couldn't even believe it. I had no idea that they grew like that in those little nests.
Isn't it amazing? I mean, I do love what farmers' market and small farmers are doing. When I get scared about the state of the world and I'm from the environmental point of view, I just think of farmers markets and people who save seed, people who are growing their own food or growing it self or small number. We are the bulwark against a lot of things in the world that are frightening to me.
Crescent. And
our industrial food system is so fragile and on such shaky ground, and yet we keep acting like there's no tomorrow with it, and there is a tomorrow.
Well, you're doing your best here, and keep up the good work. And, and I can't wait to work our way through this. This is the kind of book Peter's going to latch on to and cook from, I know.
Well, I hope you play your way through it rather than work. I hope it's big fun for you.
I think it will be.
And lots of delicious eating.
And it's also fun talking to you again, as always.
Thank you, Anne.
What a delight you are.
And thank you, Peter.
Okay.
He's quiet.
Yeah, I'm quiet.
He's working all the controls. He's doing all the controls.
I gave up trying to get a word in edgeways. So all I get a chance to say is thank you so much for joining us today on the menu, Crescent Dragon Wagon, and may you come back soon with another piece of food literature.
Thank you both so much.
And we'll be back with a final segment right after this.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
We're back in closing out today's program with an interesting book by an interesting author.
Yeah, we forgot to mention, I mean, she does baking, essentially, so it's a baking book.
Yeah, it's a baking book, okay.
Yeah, and she combines it with the idea of scrapboarding.
Yeah, sort of scrapbooking, scrapbooking and using the memories of recipes in different kinds of ways.
Yeah.
Very, very interesting, I'm sure you'll agree. And
preserving them at the same time.
Oh, okay, yeah.
The whole history.
Yeah, you have anything more to plug in before I launch it?
I think I do the interview, so we'll just go right on to that.
Okay.
Well, when I first saw this book, Rebecca Miller French's book called Sweet Home, subtitled Over 100 Heritage Desserts and Ideas for Preserving Family Recipes, I assumed it was just another dessert book, especially a family recipe book. We've been getting a whole bunch of those, Rebecca, because I don't know why, because people's parents are getting Alzheimer's and the recipes are getting lost. But when I opened your book, it's a whole new take on everything. It's about actually telling people, encouraging them and telling them how to save their family's recipes.
Absolutely, before they get lost, like you're saying. I mean, I think they get water stained, I think people misplace them, and there are other ways, you know, if you don't have that perfect family album, there are ways to preserve family history.
I mean, I have like all these Aunt Clara's baking recipes, and they're in a book, a recipe journal, that is all crumbled, yellowed and crumbled.
Right, and so that's, I give craft ideas in the book. You can, I don't know if you saw the photo, but there's recipes can be transferred to platters. beautiful because you can serve on the platters. You know, it almost looks like it's a creamware type platter. The company, the source, CustomSepia.com, they can even transfer an actual recipe card with those watermarks, everything. It's as if you Xerox it onto the platter. So it's ideas like that, preserving recipes on aprons, preserving recipes on tea towels.
Well, let's go back to the core. I mean, what got you started on this was a death in your family and a heritage recipe
journal. It was my mother gave me my great Aunt Phoebe's recipe journal that had belonged to my great grandmother, and it was a beautiful book, old, antiqued, and you know I thought, oh, this is such a wonderful family possession to own, and kind of set it aside. I looked through it, but my daughter Anna, who really, really just appreciates history and all things old, took a lot of time and really read through it. So it was several autumns ago, I was trying to make a donut recipe, replicating an apple cider donut from our area, and I just couldn't get it right. They were chewy, they weren't good. So Anna said to me, why aren't you trying the donut recipe in the journal, which I hadn't even really realized was in there. I don't know why I hadn't made anything from this treasure trove that I had here. So we tried it, and they were so good. It was unbelievable. So,
you have that recipe in this book.
Yeah, the apple cider donuts. And yeah. They're so, in the fall, just the smell while they're frying in the oil. Oh, it's so, I called my grandmother, and I asked her about this donut recipe and about this journal, and what was so funny, first of all, she couldn't even believe I had this journal. She said, you have that? My great aunt never let her see it.
Oh, no.
So all of a sudden, these stories of just kind of this family feud that I didn't realize had existed. And then, you know, even more particular was this special recipe that she used to make with her mother for this women's cooperative in Madison. I didn't even know she baked like that. So but they were baking these, you know, making these by the dozens on the weekends in Madison, Wisconsin.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, tell us about the organization of the book, because that explains a lot about what this book's mission is.
Yeah, so I divided it into four chapters. It's preserving, celebrating, giving, and creating. And so the preserving chapter is the one that really, that's where I share most of our family recipes and desserts that are special to us and ideas for ways that you can preserve your own family dessert recipes. Our Norwegian heritage comes out in this chapter through, do you know what a rosette iron is?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Rosettes and crumb caca. And we also explored my husband's heritage, Jamaican. So we have a Jamaican sweet potato pudding in there.
That was a wonderful story about your trip.
We went with my father-in-law. It was last year.
How old was he? He was old.
87.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he, you know, he always talked about this Jamaican sweet potato pudding, and we get for it, and my mother-in-law had died. So we went down there, and there was a local chef who said, come back tomorrow, and we'll show you how to do it. We had no idea what we were getting ourselves into. We got there at like 3, and I think we left it, you know, 8:30, 9 o'clock at night.
Oh.
And we cooked it, and they said, we're going to cook it el on top, el on bottom. And I had no idea what they were talking about. So my father-in-law had to translate. It was hell on top, hell on bottom, because the fire, the coals are on the top, and the coals are on the bottom. So it's that heat that the pudding, it makes this really wonderful custardy, sweet cream on the top that you just want to scrape off and eat, you know, without even the bottom part. It's so delicious. So we sat there, and we had a wonderful dinner, all of us, with the, you know, Jamaican cook and his staff, and the pudding probably cooked for 2.5-3 hours over these coals, and they kept tending to it. And I think for the girls, so my husband was there, and my girls had reddish brown hands from the soil that was covering the potatoes, you know, so while they're sitting there peeling and grating the potatoes, it was just a great experience for all of us, and they really got to appreciate how it used to be done, you know, instead of just sticking it in the oven and walking away, you had to tend to the coals and keep it going.
Well, you feel that desserts are an essential part of life, which it took me a while to relate to that, because we don't have desserts at all.
Well, that's, you know, and I find that, and a lot of people are so diet conscious and health conscious that, you know, there is something to be said for that, but just a little bit, even if it's a little piece of brownie or, you know, half of a cupcake, my neighbor actually, I got a little clue from her, is that she bakes all the time, and she, you know, super healthy, but what she does is she'll keep one or two cupcakes at home or a piece of cake, and then she gives all the rest to her neighbors. So she'll call and say, oh, we have something for you.
Yes.
So, and that's part of the giving chapter, you know, is really sharing things you bake and, you know, let everybody have a little bit. You don't have to sit down and eat the whole cake.
So you start with preserving and you explain how people should approach that, huh?
Yeah. So, and there are, so the preserving chapter, there are the ideas for how you can do it, and a lot of our family recipes are in there. A lot of recipes that I took from the journal, as I said, a lot speak to our Norwegian heritage, my mother's banana cake, there are Frango mint brownies. I'm from the Midwest, and Frangos were a big part of my childhood.
What are Frangos? I've lived in Indianapolis for a while. I went to school in Ann Arbor. What are Frangos?
Oh, you did in Michigan. Yeah. They're, you know what? They're from, they started out west, and Marshall Field bought the rights to them. And Marshall Field, it really became like their signature chocolate mint. It's like a chocolate mint, almost like a mint melt-away.
Oh, it's a mint, you were saying. Okay.
Minty, yeah, so Frango mint. And you chop those up. So Macy's carries them now. They're hard to find. I don't know how much longer.
Yeah, I wondered where you got cloud berries.
Yeah, wow, they were preserves. I know they're very hard to find. I know somebody who was working on a shoot, and they had them imported. I don't know if they were from Iceland or Norway.
Oh, okay.
He said they didn't make it too well.
Rebecca, so you are encouraging and explaining how to preserve. What is this about celebrating?
Celebrating chapter gives ideas for ways to enhance celebration, ways traditions, carry traditions on, everything from a candle ring, which is a German tradition, to cloth banners, to sing a plate a year. So there are all kinds of ideas that you can make small moments big. And I really think even like that, the smallest detail, just putting a simple cupcake on a cake stand and putting a flower from outside or a tissue paper flower, that really makes the birthday person feel special or the person being celebrated. Maybe you celebrate because, you know, your child won a soccer game or your husband got a promotion.
And how did the dog get adorned with a hat?
Yeah, there's a really cute picture in the book because my photographer loves their dog and our dog loves the photographer. And it's funny because the cupcake's totally gone. She hated it. We're trying to get her eating a cupcake and she hated it in about 2 seconds.
Aw, how cute.
But yeah, she's a very patient. She's a Chesapeake Bay Retriever and the kids always dress her up in hats and scarves. But that's part of it. It's just wearing a hat, you know, having a birthday crown. We have a birthday crown that everybody wears. Even my husband will put it on, or his father if he's visiting. And really just elevating those small moments. And that this year, it was really sweet. On my birthday, my daughter said, please wake me up at 5:30. Get me up early. And I thought, oh, no, what is this? So I got her up. I didn't say anything. She said, get back in bed. And when I came downstairs, she had pulled out our box of tissue paper flowers and banners and had decorated the whole, you know, and it was just so sweet. But she was already starting that tradition that I had hooked in still in her, and of course she'll share with her family. So I think that whether you're having a cake or a pie or, you know, it's not just cakes and cupcakes in this chapter, as discussing earlier, that pies can be used for birthdays. You can have, we have a really cute cake and a cone, the little wacky cupcake cone.
Yeah, I just saw that.
Yeah, so you can have all kinds of different things. And I think that really there's the nostalgia when you smell that cake baking or, you know, growing up, I always had German chocolate cake or Boston cream pie. You know, just eating that and smelling that, it takes me back to a place of childhood that is so happy. And, you know, I think with the celebrating chapter, that's what I hope is that people will use these recipes to create their own traditions, spend time with family. So it really is that time in the kitchen, the time around the table, it's a bonding.
And then we talked a little bit about giving. I mean, you can't consume just endless sugar, can you?
Right, exactly. No, and that, I think, it really is such a special gift. It's something that you've taken the time to make, I think, especially a way to just bring it up to even another level is adding a recipe, giving that, whether it's a cake or a bar or a cookie, give the recipe and maybe the special ingredient. I have a pistachio pound cake in
that
the chapter. It's moist and dense, and being able, you know, giving a bag of the pistachios with the recipe, so when the person wants to make it and they don't have to call you for the recipe, they have it, and for them it'll bring back happy memories. I think another, these recipes in the chapter, they're a little, durable is probably the wrong word, but they, you know, they don't need to be eaten within 3 hours. They don't need to be refrigerated. These are ones that can be sent through the mail or, you know, stay on a car ride. There's a
Kahlua chocolate pound cake that my sister had developed for her mother-in-law, and she sent it to California every holiday season for her, and Pat would eat part of it and freeze part of it. Again, it's just that memory of every year that she would expect that that would come, and these recipes are really easy to make, and I think, like, going back to the bundt cake, another way that you can even make them more special is giving the special ingredient, like the pistachios, or, say, the bundt cake, the pan that it was made in. Bundt cake pans, you know, they're a little pricey, maybe $25 or $30, but if you want to give a really nice gift, you can give the cake in the pan. That's something that person will always have, yeah.
I like your love-struck sour cherry pie with the little hearts on it. I mean, that's so beautiful.
Thank you. That is my most favorite. I just discovered sour cherries actually living on the East Coast in the Hudson Valley. My neighbor had introduced me to them, and she would go crazy, like driving all over trying to find them to the different farm stands because not everybody would carry them. And I can't remember if it was last year, 2 years ago, the rain was so bad, the cherries just didn't grow. It was too soggy. And there were none to be found. We had to resort to frozen ones, which they're the great source. I give it in the book in Michigan for frozen sour cherries, which are really big. Well, you've lived in Michigan.
Right, yeah. Where those growers, the Upper Peninsula, I was in Ann Arbor. Yeah, the farmer's market had them last year. He actually took orders from people for them. I guess they're fragile.
Oh, that's smart. Yeah. They are. They're so fragile, but so worth it, right?
But through all of this now, you've been creating the ideas for gifts and creating also modifications to your recipes, which is something I paid a lot of attention to because, I mean, half of the recipes that I inherited are unusable because the measurements are so bad.
Or no measurement at all.
Yeah. But you adjusted your recipes for that, too.
Exactly. And it was a lot of testing, and I had a whole group of testers out there because, you know, they didn't always work at first. And that's one of the ideas I really try to underscore in the book is the importance of cooking next to someone you love, you know, being with your mother, your grandmother, your uncle, your neighbor, your friend, whomever, and really seeing their technique and how they do it. When I got the crumb caca iron, I had never made them with my grandmother. She had just sent it to me, and I was trying to make them over our gas stove, and they were sticking, and it wasn't working, so I had it on speakerphone while I was trying to make them. She was explaining to me, and I just wish that, as she taught me how to make her coffee cake, I stood by her side, and she told me how to do the crisscross fold and roll cinnamon rolls, but for some reason, we just never made rosettes or crumb caca, so encourage people enough to really just say, Grandma, can I have an hour of your time? Grandpa, will you show me how to do this, and just record, and if people don't use measurements, which a lot of people, you know, they just, I've seen people
they
make
never
crazy.
Did. Yeah, they never
did. They don't. So take your own measuring cups and ask them if they'll fill the cups, and sometimes they get a little annoyed with you, but just
Well, how does all this differ from what's the difference in this creating chapter?
The creating is for families who really don't have a recipe-rich history, for people who enjoy cooking, enjoy eating, and really want to start something, and it's they can start now. I think food tells so much about places people have traveled to, people they've met. When we go somewhere, we like to come home and try and recreate things we've had. From our trip to Jamaica, we had really good passion fruit bread pudding, and so I came home and tried to recreate that, and when we ate that, it took us back to Jamaica and our trip and the resort we stayed at. So creating the ingredients, you'll see cocoa nibs, passion fruit, dulce de leche, things that my grandmother would probably be very exotic to her. She was flour, sugar, butter, eggs, and that was it. Oreo, maybe.
Yeah, I'm surprised that you were biased against lard. I mean, lard is coming back big time.
Yeah, no, my grandmother said, she said, oh, you can just replace it with butter. They used to get hand-rendered lard from the farmer down the street.
It's supposed to be much healthier than anything else you'd be using, huh?
Yeah, and for some reason people are very turned off by it, so I just hesitated to go there. But yeah, I think, and I think butter does give things a very good, rich flavor. But so you'll see in the creating chapter different, a little more sophisticated recipes and flavors. And again, there's some more ideas of, keeping less of menus and places you've gone and taking classes, so it's encouraging people to start their own history now.
Well, all the photos of you and your family, having fun. It certainly looks like you have a good thing going there.
We love being in the kitchen. I mean, it's so funny because it's probably, like, I don't want to say the smallest room in the house, but we're always all in there, just packed in there. It's fun, you know. It's a great place to be. We have a lot of fun in there. We all love to eat.
Well, I hope that listeners get the central message of this book, that it's, again, one of those traditions that used to flourish in all countries, actually, even in American society, and it's sort of at risk of getting lost now. But mm-hmm. you have some clues as to how to find your way home again in this book. Once again, let's go, Sweet Home by Rebecca Miller French, with two F's.
For French.
Yeah, and you'll like the strawberry shortcake on the cover.
That's
one of my memories.
Yeah, big mound of whipped cream and fresh strawberries. They're delicious.
Well, Rebecca, much luck with your book and with your preserving. And it would be nice to be your neighbor so I could get all those extra baked goods that you produce.
Yeah. I think my neighbors, they don't even pick up the phone now. No more!
Oh, dear.
It's a good time.
Well, as I said, have fun. Have good time with your book. And good luck and success.
Thank you. It was really nice speaking with you.
Thanks, Rebecca.
All right. Take care. Thanks.
And we'll be here if you'll be here. Same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.